Today's Teisho will be on Case 20 in the Book of Serenity. Case 20 is entitled Dijong's Nearness. Introduction, the profound talk entering into noumenon decides three and weeds out four. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Suddenly, if you can open your mouth and explain fully, take a step and walk, then you can hang your bowl and bag up high and break your staff. But tell me, who is this? Case. Dijong asked Feon, "Where are you going?" Feon said, "Around on a pilgrimage." Dijong said, "What is the purpose of the pilgrimage?" Feon said, "I don't know." Dijong said, "Not knowing is nearest." Verse. Having studied to the full, it's like before. Having shed entirely the final thread, the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him. The purpose of 10 years' pilgrimage, clearly, he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows. Well, today is the final day of our really glorious October Sesshin, autumn Sesshin, and people have done a wonderful job. Some people were able to come for the whole 5 days, others for a shorter period of time, but really excellent practice here this morning in this endo. So I would like to suggest that this is a koan about the value of not knowing. I don't want to undo the koan by trying to explain Zen as a system, although I probably will. So at the end of the discussion, you can just forget everything I'm going to say. You come to Sesshin the first time, and some of you are here for the first time, it's really quite bizarre, right? I mean, you get up early in the morning, you're sitting on a cushion all day long, watching your breath. You're going into Dokusan at the end of the day. All of this is different from ordinary life in so many ways. Perhaps the greatest difference is one that's not necessarily obvious at first, you know, because everybody's caught up in the novelty of Sesshin, you know. And that is that you're really using a different kind of intelligence at Sesshin. Normally, people's minds are working in a very different kind of a register. You know, ordinarily, we get up in the morning and we say, you know, what'll I have for breakfast? You know, and maybe I'll have eggs, you know, and then you go down and you get the eggs out of the refrigerator and you think, scrambled or omelet, you know, and omelet, cheese, no cheese, peppers, you know, and basically your mind is working like that pretty much all day long, you know. When I get to work, I have to I have to do all kinds of things that are related to my job. I have to, you know, maybe we'll have some problem that's arisen, and I have to make some decisions. And people will call me up and ask for my advice, or you know, I'll have to grade papers and meet with students, And, you know, I sit and look at, you know, a manuscript and think, how could this be revised? And then I think, lunch. Where will I go to lunch? Indian? Chinese? Thai? You know? And then, you know, maybe I get one of my friends to go to lunch with me and we talk about a movie we saw or something in our, you know, in politics, how unhappy we are with the state of the world, you know. And that always makes us happy, you know, to talk about that. You know, what a, the place is going to hell in a handbasket, and by the end of the conversation we're laughing and so on, you know, shaking our heads with joy at how bad things are getting. You know. So you know, this is like all day long we're using a kind of intelligence which is based upon, if you think about it, well, I mean, first of all, there's nothing wrong with using that kind of intelligence, right? It's necessary. It's necessary. And it's actually quite extraordinary. You know, it's quite extraordinary. You know, the older I get, the more I'm impressed by people's creativity and their intelligence, you know. I like the arts. And I will, I'll read a review of somebody's paintings, and I'll look at the paintings and just think, my God, those are wonderful. Or, you know, I like music, so I'm a kind of a late. I came to a composer named John Adams very late in my life. I just discovered him last year, and I love his music. And I'm a subscriber to Rhapsody. So for $10 a month, I can get unlimited music. And I listen to it all day long at work when I'm, grading papers and when I don't need to concentrate intensely. And I listen to his music and just think, my gosh, what an amazing composer, you know. And so there is this wonderful, wonderful, this kind of intellect, this that plans, that designs, that thinks, you know, is really a wonderful thing. It's wonderful, and so many good things come out of that, you know. Yen isn't here at the Sesshin, but I was talking to him, and he was saying Yen, some of you know, is a long, long time member of our group, more than 15 years. And he's a statistician, and he's a statistician. His company works for the drug companies. And, you know, they will spend years developing a new drug, and they have no idea if it's going to work, and they spend millions and millions of dollars. And then they do the clinical trials, and Yen's team evaluates the statistically evaluates the effectiveness of the trials. And apparently this is a grueling procedure, and it requires extraordinary intelligence, you know, great skill and expertise and knowledge. Many years ago, when Yen was finishing his PhD and he wrote his dissertation, his English isn't that good, so he asked me to read his dissertation and go through and edit it for the English mistakes. And I swear to you, I could not follow a single thing in his dissertation. I mean, first of all, there was very little English in it, you know. It was almost all signs and symbols. It was like, if this, and then it was a blah, 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 you know, and so like, you know, and it would go on and on, then blah, 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 blah. However, blah, 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 you know. And if a monkey had typed it on the keyboard, it would have looked the same to me, you know. In other words, you know, there were these symbols and, you know, plus, minus, squiggle, something, you know. I literally, you know, all I could do is make sure his prepositions were right, you know, basically, and that it looked like a sentence, you know. And if that's, you know, so highly skilled, right, you know, highly skilled. And this kind of intelligence is really extraordinary because, after all, you know, that medicine might make the lives of many people very much better. On the other hand, it, you know, basically, if the clinical trials don't work, people need to be protected from that medicine in case the pharmaceutical company has a powerful desire to market it anyway because they've spent all this money. So you know, he's doing really crucial work that benefits many people. Artists and writers also have this, you know, this ability to use the intellect, the discriminating intellect, with great skill, and composers and so on. So this kind of intelligence is really important, but on the other hand, it has its limits. You know, it has its limits because. You know, it really isn't the case that the world fundamentally makes sense. I really don't believe that the world fundamentally makes sense. What I would say is that parts of the world can be explained in ways that make sense, but that the whole thing rests on the whole structure of what makes sense rests on something that's bigger, that doesn't make sense, you know, and that can't make sense. I know that sounds very abstract, but basically life doesn't really make sense, you know, I would say. If you ask a question, if you look at a work of art and you say, you know, you might say, oh my gosh, this is so brilliantly done, or this composition and music is so brilliantly done. Or you look at a technical innovation like a car that doesn't use gas, you know, that uses electricity. You might think, you know, that's really astonishing. But then if you think, well, but why painting at all, right? Why paint at all? Why are you painting, you know, why are you taking brushes and putting them into paint, pigments, and putting it on a canvas? Why even do that? Or, you know, if you think about, you know, music, why do we even have music, right? I mean, we're just making sounds. Why are we making these sounds, you know? Or for that matter, you know, science is wonderful, but why do we do this? You know, why do we even do this? Why have a car? You know, people live for hundreds of thousands of years without cars. Why have cars? And so, my feeling is that when you get to that level, you see that there's a lot we can't explain rationally, you know. Probably, people are scientists for reasons they can't even explain, you know. So somebody might say, I'm a scientist because I want to solve environmental problems, but I actually doubt that's why they became a scientist. You know, my brother was a biology major in college, and he, when he was a little boy, like 4 years old, he started buying these plastic dinosaurs. I don't know if you know about those, but in the world of children, there are these little dinosaurs. They're probably 3 inches. Some of them are 3 inches tall. They're made out of rubber or plastic, and you can get many different dinosaurs. I myself had no interest in dinosaurs at all, but my brother, from the time he was little, was fascinated by dinosaurs. And I remember I would come into his room, and he would be sitting there, and he'd say, Brontosaurus, Stegosaurus, T-Rex, you know, and he had, you know, and he'd say, Allosaur, I think it is, and then, you know, there'd be others, and I'd Pterodactyl, and he had all of these, he had collected them, and he knew their names, and he had books on dinosaurs, you know, when he got older, he became kind of pompous about it, like, you know, I'd say, well, does this dinosaur attack, you know, the duck-billed platypus? And he'd say, they didn't exist at the same time. You know, that's ridiculous, you know, or, you know. at the same time, my brother, you know, he would go out in the woods and he would come back and he'd say, tell my mom, I'd see him and he'd be sitting there and he'd say, Mom, I saw a dinosaur footprint in the forest, you know. And my mother would go, really, Peter? You know, that's wonderful, you know. And you know, I didn't really know then. You know, I knew there weren't any dinosaurs, but it was for my brother going out into the woods, and there was indeed in the woods where we used to live in Baltimore, there was a bird sanctuary near the school where we went to school. And it was a beautiful place, and little kids can go play in the bird sanctuary. And there was like this big hole in the ground, you know, this mysterious hole. And in my brother's mind, that was a ancient dinosaur footprint, you know. So anyway, my brother, when he went to college, he became a biology major. Because, you know, now, he didn't really get into this because, in my opinion, biology, you know, he liked difficult questions of, you know, genetics, or something had already happened to him very early on that was very gripping and engaging on a very deep level. You know, his reasons for becoming interested in biology weren't really explainable on the level of biology problems, right? You know, there was something about, you know, who knows what it was, you know, little kids may, you know, I've heard all kinds of theories, right? Like, little kids feel powerless, and dinosaurs are big and powerful, you know. Little children, especially little boys, feel like they're monstrous. This is another psychoanalytic theory, that kids, little boys feel like, you know, they're often breaking things, or doing the wrong thing, or being too loud. You know, your parents are always saying, "You know, you're too loud. You can't scream like that. You know, sit down." You know, and kids can feel like monsters, or I'm like a big dinosaur trapped in a little world. You know, so you know, there's lots of ways of explaining why my brother got interested in dinosaurs, but it resonated on a very deep level, and when he went to college, he found these questions engaging. And I think this is really very a richer picture of the human being, that we have this rational mind which can do these beautiful things, but that we also have this deeper life, which is sort of deeper than reason. And we often neglect it. When we come to Sesshin, you know, we're really learning how to activate this deeper intelligence. Zen is like going back, in a way, you could say, to that time when, at that part of the mind which was, you know, being formed when my brother bought his dinosaurs. It's a part of the mind that could be cultivated more fully, but we forget about it. We don't pay attention to it in the modern world so much. I think ancient people really, especially like in ancient China, they really understood the importance of this. You know, somebody like Lao Tzu in China was always warning, you know, don't get too caught up in the discriminating mind. You know, what really matters in life is this. The discriminating mind is like the tip of an iceberg, but the iceberg is this other life we have, you know. You know, we can neglect that or become ignorant about this other life, you know. So when we come to Sesshin, we're sort of revitalizing this deeper part of ourselves that can be almost like starved, right? You know, we live in a world that's very narrow sometimes. You know, it's capable of, you know, astonishing complexity, but on the other hand, it's a little bit thin. Maybe I shouldn't say narrow. It's thin. You know, there's you know, something about it that doesn't go very deep. You know, or the thing we love about it is really on a deeper level. So basically, you know, when we come to Sesshin, we're learning how to get back in touch with that part of ourselves that maybe we forgot, or maybe we neglected. And we're revitalizing this part of ourselves that can become dead or dormant. I hope that makes some sense. But there's this other way of relating to the world which isn't intellectual. It isn't theoretical or instrumental, you know? Maybe that's one way to put it. When we think, you know, thinking is like a way of structuring the world or controlling the world. It's really based on control, and I'm not putting it down. You know, you do need to control things, right? So, for example, this morning it got very cold outside, and the heaters clicked on, and we could hear them in the Zendo, clink, clink, tinkle, tinkle. And I find that sound incredibly reassuring, right? Because I know it's cold outside, and I hear these little panels binging and in the heating units, and I think, heat, how nice, you know. So, that kind of control is very satisfying. I was having some car problems before Sesshin, and I had to take my car in, and I was very frustrated with my Toyota Matrix. It's not the car I thought it was. I'm kind of disappointed. And it's not reliable. And so when I have to get somewhere, sometimes I've been having some trouble. I want to be able to control myself. You know, I want to be able to control my transportation. You know, okay. So that's control. Now, there's another part of ourselves, though, there's another way of knowing which isn't based upon control. It's not based on control. And it's based on connectedness and trust, right? No matter how good our technical knowledge, you really have to rely ultimately on trust. And no matter how much you can control, you can't control everything, you know. Even people who are, you know, brilliant surgeons, for example, you know, they, no matter how skilled they can be, you know, they lose people. My sister works in a hospital, and she was telling me, sometimes I'll call my sister up, and I love her so much, and she's such a hardworking person. And if you let her, she'll tell you one medical horror story after another. And, you know, she lives in a world of real medicine, so it's not like on TV. And she's in a place where patients come in, they're diagnosed, they die on the operating table, people come into the hospital to be treated for something, they get an infection in the hospital, they die. And there are many other ways of dying at the hospital. And so you realize that, you know, medical science is very refined, but there's a lot of contingency in the system. You know, and so I think, you know, even very expert people in medicine have to rely on trust because there's a high level of uncertainty. You know, and I think that a level of uncertainty is like inescapable in life. It's inescapable. So when we do anything, no matter how skillfully, we have to trust in the process, right? If you are a scientist, you know, you're doing an experiment. It's based on the research of other people. You've devised the most careful experiment you can do. And basically, it might or might not work. No matter how careful you are, there's a kind of contingency, you know. And so, just to be able to do scientific research requires a kind of trusting mind, you know, trusting mind. And if you worry too much about whether your experiment is going to work, you'll really cripple yourself. You know, you won't do science, you'll quit. And this happens to people in, like, writing. You know, I have worked with people who have writer's block. One of the things I do is teach writing. And it's fascinating to meet people who like might have been successful writers for a long time, and they develop a block. And it's usually connected to some kind of a setback, you know. So you know, when people start like writing, start their careers as writers, you know, they're usually people who are talented in this area. They have, it's like my brother with his dinosaurs, you know, something about writing or about literature appealed to them when they were very young, you know. And maybe there was their mother telling them nursery, you know, having them recite nursery rhymes. But for some reason, you know, when they're adults, they like poetry or they like literature. And, you know, sometimes when people start their lives as adults, you know, when they do something, it's, it feels very natural, you know. So there's a famous writer, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wanted to be a writer from the time he, earliest he could remember, he wanted to be a writer. And he wrote a book, and his first book was an enormous hit. And it made him famous overnight and rich. You know, it was like everything you ever dreamed about if you're a writer. He wrote this book, it came out, it was a bestseller, there were movie rights. And basically, he had been living from hand to mouth. His fortune was made, and then he wrote another book, and it was like a critical disaster. You know, it was a huge flop. And then after that, he no longer had trust in himself, and he developed a drinking problem. He spiraled into a sad period in his life. You know. And he said, you know, when I started writing, it was as natural as a bird singing. But then I lost my trust. I lost my trust in myself. And I was paralyzed, you know. And he went through a long period of writer's block. You know, in Zen, there's a story, which is one of these little Zen stories, which is a little too smug, maybe, you know. But it goes, there was a centipede walking along the ground, and he has 100 legs, and they're all walking very effectively. And then he walks up to an ant, and the ant says, "You have 100 legs. How do you do that exactly? How do you move them all?" And then he was paralyzed, and he died. Right? He couldn't do it. He couldn't move his legs anymore. You know. That's the story. But he lost his trust, right? He lost his trust, you know. So he didn't ever think about it. It's just as natural as a bird singing, right? And then suddenly, you know, what? How do I move them? Can I move them? You know, and this doubt. Probably anybody who's done koan training has this experience, right? Where you get a koan and you think, oh, you know, I'll never answer this. You know, this is impossible, blah, blah, blah. And the more you think about it, of course, the worse it becomes. And so you know, Fitzgerald's such an interesting case because after he actually wrote a book about his problem called The Crack-Up. And he went into deep depression and became an alcoholic. And then he sort of worked his way out. He recovered his trust. You know, things got so bad for him that he sort of like gave up hope, but he kept writing. He kept writing, and somehow he recovered his trust. And he wrote a couple books that were he wrote The Great Gatsby, which is even now widely read. And then he wrote this other beautiful book called Tender is the Night. And it's really wonderful, of his final completed work, you know. And he had gone through hell of self-doubt, right? But he recovered his trust and really did his very best work, you know, after this crisis. So we really live on trust. And our discriminating mind is really not a trusting mind. It's really not capable of trust. In fact, it's really that's not its job. You know, but But any kind of successful activity with the discriminating mind requires a kind of deeper grounding. It requires a relationship to the world based on trust. You know, and so, you know, Zen practice is all about restoring that trusting mind. We recite every morning, it's the verses on the heart mind, and you say the great way is one with the trusting mind. And you might think, well, yeah, trusting mind, what's that all about? But it's very, very important. The trusting mind isn't a discriminating mind. It's this, you sit down on the cushion, and you don't, it's not based on control. The discriminating intellect is based on controlling things, right? And that desire to control is almost, it can be carried to a certain point, can become very unhealthy, because all creative activity involves letting go. Letting go. You know, learn, you can't learn if you don't let go to some degree. I was listening, one of the shows I really like is Car Talk. I don't know if you listen to Car Talk, but I love Car Talk. And Tom and Ray Miazzi are both MIT trained scientists. And I actually think they may both have, one of them anyway, has a PhD. And somebody called up on the show one day, and he was a scientist, and they both burst into laughter. And they said, oh, you poor guy, you know. Because they were laughing, they said, we feel sorry for you, you know. They got out of science, and they went into, you know, basically they run a car repair business, you know. And they said, you poor guy, and they both laughed, and they said, you know, most experiments fail, you know. And they said, it's a hell of a life, or something like that, you know, because you're constantly failing, you know. I think you can drive yourself crazy if you just live in the discriminating intellect, you know, because failure is essential. It's essential. And it only throws us if we don't have a well-developed, if we don't have a well-developed big mind, you know. So in the modern world, you know, we don't necessarily have the equipment to deal with failure because we haven't cultivated this bigger heart mind, this other kind of intelligence, you know. So you know, when we fail on the level of the discriminating mind, you know, if we're grounded in this bigger life, it's easier to deal with. It's easier to deal with, you know. Failure is inevitable. It's never-ending, you know. And it can be terrifying if we haven't cultivated this deeper mind. So when we come to Sesshin, we're cultivating a deeper mind, you know, this trusting mind. And it's, I think this is so essential for a healthy life and a creative life. I was reading a biography of I don't think Jaru would mind my saying this. You know, Jaru, I met Jaru's husband before he was Jaru's husband. He was a PhD student in philosophy at Rutgers. And he was on his way to the PhD, and he realized his parents are both academics, and they said, "We want you to get a PhD. That's just a thing." And he said, "You know," at some point he said, "I don't really want to be a professor of philosophy. I find this stuff really dull. I'm not interested in this anymore." And he decided he wanted to be a screenwriter, right? And you might think, "Oh, brother, you know, what are the chances?" You know, so he didn't get his PhD, and he started taking courses in screenwriting. And he started writing screenplays. Okay, and you might think, "This guy, this is crazy. You know, not a chance, right?" Jaru said he would get up every morning and write. And he actually, Jaru said he loves writing screenplays. And by the way, they've made a couple movies out of some of his screenplays. And now he's in Hollywood. Yes, this is true. He's in Hollywood, and he's actually teaming up with the guy who did the script for RoboCop, if you remember RoboCop. One of the great cinematic achievements of the previous century. Nevertheless, a commercial success, you know. Okay. And he's getting calls from other people too who want him to write, you know. So Jaru reported to me. She said, Steve, she said, does not eat any vegetable if he can help it. When they go out to dinner and have a hamburger, he'll take the vegetables out of his hamburger. And she said, now that he's in California, though, of course, everybody will order vegetarian. So she said, he's actually eating vegetables. She's happy to report. But see, I think his story is really remarkable. Because, you know, most people don't have enough trusting mind to, most people would be thinking, okay, I'm in the graduate program at Rutgers. I don't really want to be a philosopher, but I should do it. My parents tell me it's a good thing, and basically, you know, I have these crazy dreams about being a screenwriter, but they're just crazy dreams. Let's be real, right? And so Steve could have gotten his PhD in philosophy. He could have gotten a job at some university and cranked out these articles that he wasn't really very interested in. And he probably would have been unhappy. But instead, he had a trusting mind. You know, I don't know how he did it. Maybe his particular childhood, you know, gave him this kind of trust, but he just had the trust to go forward with this plan. And, you know, he gets up every day, and Jaru said, he recently said to her, I would like to do this until I'm 80 years old. I find this so interesting. Now there's somebody who, now again, this is something the rational mind can't explain. It's not a miracle, it's just deeper than reason, right? So if you said, Steve, why do you like to write screenplays, right? I mean, I'm sure he couldn't tell you. He'd just say, I love it, you know, it's enjoyable, or beats me, you know. It resonates with him on a level that's deeper than the discriminating mind, than reason. And he has deep roots, he's able to trust himself and to trust the process enough, you know. So we're cultivating this other deeper intelligence, and it's Zen is not anti-intellectual. In China and in Japan, you know, some very, very brilliant people came out of the Zen world. You know, if you've ever read the Kyoto School of Philosophers, you can see that. You know, they're incredibly tough. They're as tough as anybody would want. You know, they're really brain-bustingly difficult, and they're all sort of Zen people. So you know, using your intellect is not a crime at all. That's not the point. That's not what Zen is getting at. What it's saying is that the discriminating mind is just is shallow, and that you need that rests on something deeper, which is this trusting mind. And when we rely too much on the resources of the discriminating mind, we become like the centipede, right? We can't move anymore. So people need to feed their big mind. They need to, things like Sesshin give people an opportunity to nourish the trusting mind. And when you have a day three experience at Sesshin, you know, day one, getting tired. Day two, at the end of your resources. And often in day two, there's a lot of negative thinking, right? There's a lot of negativity coming up, you know? And then there's this turning point in day three where you suddenly feel everything's great. You know, earlier in the sesshin I mentioned, when I first started doing sesshin, around day two or day three, all these people would come into Dokusan and I'd go, how's it going? They'd go, terrible. Oh, I'm so unhappy. I wish I hadn't come. I hate this. I hate life. And I thought, oh my God, what am I doing wrong? You know, I'm a failure as a teacher, you know. And then by day five, people come, oh, it's wonderful. Thank you. You know, thank you. This is so great. You know, how did you do it? You know, and it's like, beats me. You know, I don't know. It's not really me. It's the process, right? It's the process. And people go through this process and they come out on the other side, and it's like the trusting mind is awakened. The deeper mind is awakened. So you know, today everybody's going to leave here and go out. You know, at the end of the day, we're all going to go home and go to our jobs, and with a nourished, trusting mind, you know. It's very important. Something like Zen is very important because it allows you to feed that deep human need. You know, when somebody asks you why did you get married? You know, what could you possibly say? Everybody gets married, but why did you get married? You know, I don't know. Exactly. You know, if you have kids, why did you have kids? You could just as easily have not had them. I don't know. See, that's the limits of the discriminating mind. You know, some people have kids because when they come home, they feel very happy and warm, and they feel very connected to the universe, you know. That's a deeper reason, right? Some people like poetry because when they read poetry, they feel a deep connection to things. They feel the universe coming together. And this is what we rediscover on the cushion when we do Zen. So, one thing I'd like you to take with you is that, the discriminating mind says, Zen, there's Zen, and there's what happens on the cushion, and then there's what happens off the cushion, and they're different. And basically, when we come to Zen, Sesshin, there's a system here in place, right? It's a system. We get up at 4:30, we start sitting at 5, we have breakfast at 8, and so on. We do Dokusan every day. You know, you sit for half an hour each time. And by day three, everybody's feeling better, and so on. It's a system. And there's a process. And if you come to Sesshin enough, you trust the process. And when you go home, you say, okay, now there's no process. Okay. But it's not true. Okay. There is a process in life, too. You know, please understand that this would be the process or the process that we find in Sesshin is not an invention of it's not an artificial invention. This is really very much based upon life itself or reality itself. In other words, when we encounter an obstacle on the cushion, and then we drop down into our deeper selves and work through the obstacle, this is something that you can do in your job, you can do in your personal relationship. It's not really an invention of Zen, it's really the way the human being is put together. If that makes any sense. So you know, the Zen Sesshin is a system, but actually the universe is a system of the same kind that we Buddhists believe. See, so Buddhists actually believe, whether you find this incredible or not, that the universe is like a machine for producing Buddhas. That's the teaching. You know, that's the teaching. The universe actually is like a giant Buddha-producing machine, okay? That's the teaching. The Dalai Lama believes that. Linji believe that. Everybody in the Buddhist world, the Buddha believes that. The world is a Buddha-producing machine. Sesshin is a Buddha-producing machine too, and that's obvious, right? But the world is a Buddha-producing machine. So there's a process outside of Sesshin too. That's my point. So basically, when you go out into the world, when you get up tomorrow and you have to go to your job, it's very important to maintain your trusting mind. And it's very important to tell yourself, maybe every day, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. You know, at Sesshin, everything is helping you wake up. You know, and people will actually trust the teacher very much. Genki Roshi could be a real pain in the ass sometimes, my teacher. And sometimes he could behave in a very childish way. And people, his students would think, oh, he's a brilliant teacher. This is all just helping me wake up. And I'd think, no, it's not. He's just a jerk, you know, right now. He's being a jerk. He said, oh, no, this is a strategy designed to help me wake up. But actually, everything is helping you wake up, right? So if you have a crisis at work and you think, oh, my God, you know, oh, my God, this is, you know, that's the discriminating mind working over time. But remember the trust, you know, what you learned on the cushion here is when you encounter an obstacle, drop down into your trusting mind. And if you just trust, a resolution comes. And this is true in life too. You know, when you're in the trusting mind, you can be creative. You can see things from new angles. You can be responsive. You can be courageous enough to rethink. When you're frozen in fear, you can't do any of those things. Yeah? So everything is helping me wake up. The Sesshin is here, but actually life is a Sesshin. If you treat life like your Sesshin, things will go really well. Life is your Sesshin, yeah, your big Sesshin, your pilgrimage, yeah. So it's a discriminating mind says this is Sesshin and that is not Sesshin. Now, please do come back to this Sesshin, you know, not just the Sesshin of life, you know. But life is a Sesshin, and if you treat life as your Sesshin, things are going to go really well. Okay, I'll wrap it up. Dijong asks Fayot, where are you going? I'm going on a pilgrimage. Dijong said, what's the purpose of a pilgrimage? I don't know. It's like, excellent answer. Okay, excellent. So he's now relying on the trusting mind, the Mushin mind. Dijong said, not knowing is nearest. You know, not knowing is closest. Not knowing is the deepest response, not knowing is the deepest response. See, people fear not knowing, but actually not knowing, as you see from your 5 days at Sesshin or your weekend at Sesshin, not knowing is really deeply liberating. Not knowing grounds you in trust, grounds you in connectedness. So it's not a crisis when you don't know. It's a great opportunity.